let's hit record and we'll, all right, we're recording. Hey. Welcome back to another episode of Mention and Dispatches here with the Armchair Dragoons. Look, I've had a post-it note sitting on my desk for like the first five episodes that we've done this, and I keep forgetting to mention. So I'm going to lead with this. Pop over to iTunes, give us a rating. If you think we're only worth one star, the fact that you're still listening to us is a little weird, but give us the one star, give us the five, give us the three and a half, whatever it is. We just need more ratings overall in order to start showing up in the recommendation engine through iTunes. And I know it's easy to pick on Apple, but iTunes still drives a lot of podcast subscriptions. So if you get a chance, pop over there. The link is in the every one of our episodes. There's the link to our page on Apple Podcasts. Just go throw us a rating so that we can start showing up in the recommendation engines. And we really appreciate. And that's not what we're going to talk to you about for an hour and change here. We've got a distinguished crew, including a pair of first timers for our podcast. Mike is not a first timer for our podcast. BB Mike is back. Mike, how are you?
And nor is he distinguished, but he's here.
He looks pretty distinguished.
He does look distinguished. You're right.
And those other two voices that you're hearing, first timers for us on our podcast, but probably not the first time you've ever heard or seen these guys talking about some stuff. Our buddy Keith is here from Lock and Load Publishing.
Hello, how are you?
How many different voices are you going to do for us tonight?
I can't do as many as the guys who do English audiobooks, but there you go. I can do a few.
And then the raucous laughter of our good buddy Herman Luttman. Herman, how are you?
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
Right before we were on recording, we did ask the question. I'm curious if you've got a more exact answer, if we should go look it up to see if you even know. How many different companies do you have games published with?
I do not know. I will have to look it up.
That's a good feeling.
Yes. I do try to spread it around a little bit. As I said to you before, every company seems to have a different niche, right? A different customer base. I found that out when I spoke to different publishers about their mailing list. And apparently they hit different people, which I find amazing because I basically am a customer of all these companies.
Yeah.
So I do try to spread it out a bit.
That's a bit of a humble brag that Herman has lost count of how many different companies and publishers.
He's forgotten more games than I've designed.
So the reason we have both Keith and Herman here is they are two of the guests that we're going to have at our fall assembly coming up in mere days as you are listening to this at Gamers Armory here in Cary, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. We've been talking for a while pre-pandemic about actually hosting a small in-person convention with the Dragoons, leveraging a lot of what we'd learned running the wargaming area at Origins. And we'd actually started some planning and so looking into some travel arrangements and some hotel arrangements for a gathering in March of 2020. And we can all guess why that didn't happen.
Timing is everything.
Timing.
Yes, it is. And the organizational skill there wasn't completely lost. The experience that we gained from those things wasn't completely lost because it did allow us to turn around and pretty rapidly react to the COVID lockdowns and put on a couple of those digital conventions that we've been doing for several years now. And I think, Mike, how many have we done at this point? Like 7, 8, somewhere around there?
Yeah.
Like not counting the Connections Online Professional Conference, just the digital conventions that we've done, including the one we did for the RPG guys for Mystaricon. I think we've done 7 or maybe 8. And we're planning on continuing to do that. But this year, we flipped the switch and started doing some in-person. We're going to start our first in-person one. And Gamers Armory, you know, graciously agreed to host us. So we're going to be in a game store. It's weird. You normally go to a convention and you've got like the vendor hall with some vendor booths. And we're in the vendor booth, which is kind of weird. Keith is coming down and going to have a couple of Lock and Loads World at War series games or events, like working off of the one game. And then Herman, I'm going to throw to you first. You've got something that like doesn't even have a BGG page because I went to link it to the event pages for for the fall assembly. And so the struggle for Zorn game that you're bringing, is it going to be in print? And is Steve going to have them for sale by the time you get here in a couple of weeks as we're recording this? And like, when do we get a BGG page on it?
BGG. Yeah, that's a good point. I guess I should build that, shouldn't I? It will not be available for sale in October. He's aiming for November.
Okay.
So I've gotten together with Steve Jones over at Blue Panther. We've known each other for a number of years. He's obviously done a lot of the printing for a lot of the other companies I've worked with. And he started his own line of games. He's decided to publish under the Blue Panther label. And he approached me. And then, of course, I had my break from White Dog Games, so which was very fortuitous. And I went to Steve, and we talked about releasing some of those games through Blue Panther. And then we, of course, talked about other projects because he really wants to expand their catalog.
Yep.
So I gave him a couple ideas, and one of them was, you know, I've always wanted to do a, it's funny, we were talking about Game of Thrones before, but kind of a Game of Thrones fantasy war game. I said, like, you know, why can't there be a fantasy war game? And I've also gotten really into cooperative games. In my group in New York, before I moved to Tennessee, we played every week, and we wouldn't play war games because most war games, as everybody knows, is mostly two-player. And we were playing a lot of, you know, like Ameritrash, Dungeon Crawl, that kind of stuff cooperatively. And we really enjoyed it. I really had a good time. It changes the strategy around, right? So instead of fight, you know, against somebody, you're trying to cooperate and do some teamwork. And it's an interesting tactics and strategy dynamic change. So I really enjoyed that. And I said, well, why can't we do that for wargaming? I mean, why can't wargames be cooperative where we're all trying to work together to beat a big baddie? So I came up with this idea to do a fantasy war game, and he liked the idea a lot. And then I got together with Ryan Heilman, who is a great guy, great designer, and his true skill is in development. He's a great developer. He's so talented at taking an idea and really, you know, really massaging it and really bringing it to fruition. So
those
we came up with this idea. I'm sorry?
Those guys are hard to find.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ryan and I met him for the first time at WBC, and we hit it off right away. We became best friends almost instantaneously. We both have the same philosophy of life and gaming and all that kind of thing. So, you know, I threw this idea at him about doing a cooperative fantasy war game, and at your at the convention is going to be the first time we're going to show it publicly, and hopefully people will enjoy it.
So, Herman, I don't think Brant's told you yet, but when you arrive for the convention, you need to check that in with me. I'm going to hold it. I'm security. I'll hold that copy for you.
And you'll never see it again.
Yeah, we're desperate. It's funny because we're desperately, I was just exchanging emails with all of them today. And we're like, well, we have to get this finished and get the prototype built before the convention. And it's a different dynamic. I haven't been through this before, but it is a lot of fun. I like having deadlines. I don't know about Keith. I don't know how you feel about that, but I like having deadlines.
I've had the luxury of not having to have hard deadlines and having the time I needed, but it was a different kind of project. But right. For my own games, I had a deadline. Literally, I was cutting counters I have a space combat game, and this is back in 2006, and I was cutting counters at the convention I was releasing it at. So I feel you. I really do.
Yeah, I know. I don't think we should do a whole podcast just on the anxiety designers go through.
The anxiety that I got in spades. Yeah.
So I remember Mike Bernicelli talking once about the most fearful part of a designer's life is when you get the final game, the final production, and in your hand, and you open the box for the first time, because this horrible feeling goes through. You're going to open it, and something's going to be horribly wrong in the final production. It's just
that's kind of like, did I miss something?
Yeah, and you look at the counter sheet and go, ah, you know, like.
So 2006, we were busy moving. I was living in Columbus, Ohio at the time. We were moving from one house to another in Columbus, and getting ready for Origins that year. I was still a publisher back then. I was self-publishing my own stuff, right? I mean, I wasn't like a real publisher like a lot of these guys out there. But I'd worked in the printing industry before. I sort of knew the production process. I was just applying it to game stuff instead of other things that I'd worked on. We'd had the counters professionally printed, but everything else we did ourselves, to include the box assembly part of all of this. So we hadn't moved into the new house yet. We had the keys. We were still doing some cleaning. training and stuff, but we took the basement and lined up like 100 open boxes all around the basement. And me, my wife, and a couple of friends walked around and we're each of us took a separate stack of components and we're just doing laps around the basement, dropping stuff in the box. So when you're talking about like cutting counters, like we were assembling boxes the night before we're showing up at Origins to set up the booth for Bayonet Games. And then we sold enough of them the first 2 days that like Friday night, we're doing that again for another like 40, 50 copies. Cause we were trying to assemble just enough to get through the convention. And then we were going to assemble the rest afterwards and be able to ship those. But yeah, I mean, that's, we were stuffing boxes on the new print run the night before we showed up at Origins. It was crazy.
Yeah. So. And I don't, I'm sure Keith's gone through this before, but I don't know if people really appreciate how difficult proofreading is.
Oh my God. I have a, there's a whole nother show on that, but yeah, go ahead. I'm with you.
Well, yeah, it is the most horrible feeling in the world. It is the most difficult thing to do when the publisher sends you, goes, here's four counter sheets. Please make sure everything's okay.
Yeah. And you're like, well, we have 15 values on each counter and they're all varying. And you have to count the number of them in case there's too many of them or too few of them.
So, I mean, I don't know if people realize, but your brain, after you get through, like, you're into the second counter sheet, your brain starts just automatically inserting the correct information.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, just get me out of this counter sheet.
That's right. So I can't tell you how many times, like, I've checked things 3, 4, 5 times, and sure enough, something comes through, and you go, how the hell did I miss that? But it's usually on the third counter sheet, right at the bottom or something, when your brain's already said those are all fine.
Right, it's the third battalion that has the wrong color.
Exactly. Exactly.
The first one's pristine and perfect.
I always had somebody else proof the counter sheets. I can do a bunch of the proofreading on the rules and the scenario sheets and stuff. I would default back to one of the tricks I learned in undergrad, because my undergrad degree is in writing and editing. And for the editing process, when you're doing proofreading, one of our lead instructors told us, and she'd worked in the industry as a tech writer forever, is you go through every word backwards. You do the whole thing backwards. And so you start it, because then you're
I've heard that.
You're not filling the blanks in with what you think is supposed to be there.
Oh, that's
when
interesting.
Reading backwards, like, you're just looking at each individual word as you go backwards to make sure the words are spelled correctly. And that's really what you're focused on.
Then
you're not reading where you miss the word the in there two times next to each other, or when the sentence wrapped to the next column and you've got the word the in there twice because it's on two different lines. Mm-hmm. You don't miss that because you're counting it backwards and you're not piecing the context of the sentence together. You're looking at each word individually. Proofreading, that kind of stuff. Yeah, I could deal with that stuff. Proofing counters would drive me just batshit crazy.
A lot of people say, I want to help with proofreading a game. I want to help proofread your game. They're like, why don't you have more proofreaders? I went through a lot of, you know, pushback from Storming the Gap because I was the only one proofing, which is wrong in and of itself. You need more than one person, period, because it's all manual and it's all specialized, because you can't proof a game unless you know the game, because there's rules cross-references and there's concepts and there's execution sequences. You have to know how to play the game before you can proof it. And that's what falls through the cracks, is, you know, and then you get down to the basic grammar and syntax. And, you know, I know my rules are in a place where they're going to stay for a long, long time, because the things that come back in terms of somebody being trying to be helpful and saying, well, you know, it should say this. And I look at that and go, let's discuss the concept of synonyms, because there, you can write a sentence how many different ways. And I'm the designer and I kind of have to say, we have to print this. So let's just go with this one. And when somebody says, well, you should change it, I'm like, it says the same thing, so we're going to leave it. And I don't mean to be mean about it at all. It's just, there's a lot of that. But, you know, finding a team to proof, you kind of have to do it in chunks. It's like, you know, I mean, what Herman's talking about is like the counter sheets. That's one element.
Right.
Rules, references. And people are like, I want an index and a table of contents. Well, table of contents is easy, but an index is a specialized literary, not war game, literary thing. Anzio first edition index. I don't think so.
Yeah, everybody wants an index.
Everyone wants an index. And, you know, my brother was a programmer, and he's come up with a way to do like a natural language kind of study and kind of get a pretty good index, actually. Yeah. It's not that you don't work on it, but it's expensive. And I'm like, it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. So when you see one, it is what it is. I can't complain about it.
Right. I bet the audience didn't think they were going to get a behind the scenes
look. I bet they didn't. I bet they didn't. But this is all the thoughts that will be in my head at the convention right. when you're playing.
We have to convince everybody how difficult it is to be designing these games.
Go back to something you'd mentioned earlier. So not necessarily like the co-op team aspect of the war game, but the idea of sort of the fantasy war game thing that that has fallen by the wayside. I think you're definitely right that today we're not seeing a lot of those, or we're seeing them marketed to non-war gamers, something like Rune Wars from Fantasy Flight.
Right.
But I remember growing up when, and this probably applies to everybody, and I know it applies to Mike, but probably to you guys as well. Growing up, like, we seamlessly bounced between role-playing stuff and wargaming stuff.
Oh, yeah.
We were back and forth all the time. And I recall playing a whole lot of different fantasy war games that were all packaged as support products to role-playing products, such as the X10 module from the old Beckme series, the Red Arrow Black Shield war game that took place in Mystara, or the Dragonlance, I think it was DL 12 or 13, that's the big fight at the Salamnic Knights Keep, where the you've got the big dragon attack going on, that was an actual war game packaged as a module. Divine Right is always the classic one that everybody holds up from TSR from way back. But I mean, those fantasy war games existed, but they existed over in the RPG space as sort of RPG support materials, not as standalone war game products.
You're right. I mean, the fantasy war games were a little bit more mainstream in the 70s, early 80s, a little bit more, like you said, a lot more crossover. I don't understand why, you know, and I have this discussion with a lot of my wargaming friends who are just, you know, I will only play historical war games. And I'm like, I like war games, whether they're sci-fi, fantasy, horror, or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I play them all. I really do. And I enjoy it. And as a designer, and I don't know, Keith, I mean, if you have done any like non-historical.
I don't actually have it up right now, but I'm actually doing a series of games based on a science fiction universe that I have.
And, that's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I liked it. For me personally, if I do, let's say, a Most Fearful Sacrifice, which is a year of research and troop deployments and where metrics. Was this unit? And when did they come in? And I got three different sources that say different things. You're wrestling with all that. And then you finally can go, oh, great. I can do a horror game. I can do whatever I want. Right?
The rules are mine.
Right. Or it's sci-fi is especially good.
I have come up
with a really cool mechanic and go, well, I'll just justify it later because it sounds really cool to do this.
Right? I've got a sci-fi concept. I'll go real fast again, not to the convention because I don't have anything I can bring to the convention except Tabletop Simulator. But one of the things I dispensed with was movement allowances. I put it at a scale where if there's a unit there, you can't go through it. Uh-huh. If you move adjacent to it, you know, the trick is, do you get adjacent to it in the timing that you want? So you move as far as you want. These are science fiction. Everybody's hover vehicles and they're all fast. Just move. The key thing in concept in combat is, do you get close to him for the assault when you want to?
Right.
And that's where you have to make a die roll, or you have to have some sort of initiative to actually do your approach. So it comes down to the hex that's adjacent, because believe me, if you're sitting there going, I've got five units, I'm going to get there, and four of those units make it, and the fifth key unit doesn't, and it's sitting a hex away, and you go, do I go through this or not? And that's the decision, as far as I'm concerned. But you have to set the unit scale big enough and the hex scale big enough. And science fiction, you can do that because all the rules are ours.
Now that Keith has talked about this really cool science fiction game, he won't have it with him.
That's right. How many people are going to come up and ask you?
I don't know. I could see what I could do.
cutting counters in your brother's place the night before, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I'll be cutting counters before the convention. It's a tradition.
If you bring it, I'll play test it with you. How's that sound?
Okay. All right. Because I mean, I've gone to, like, you know, when I do play test counters, I don't do counters anymore. I spent years trying to figure out how to cut counters in my house and get electronic cutters and everything. I go with like the basic Scrabble tile sized colored tiles. And so I can make up a bunch of forces.
I don't know if Brant told you or not, but you're gonna have to bring all prototypes with you in order to get into the convention and check.
All right, here's what you do. You get like a 70-inch screen and a laptop, and I can show you this stuff on Tabletop Simulator because I have it.
I have so a projector.
This is interesting, Keith. I don't want to detract, but you use Tabletop Simulator.
Yes.
David Thompson told me about a year and a half ago. We're writing back and forth, and he says, you got to get Tabletop Simulator. It's the greatest thing for playtesting. And I'm really bad with, you know, advanced computer shit, you know. But I said, all right, I'll try it out. It is such a great tool. I mean, I have not
prototyping
a physical kit in over a year. Everything goes on Tabletop Simulator. I can play test with Fred in New York, or you guys if you wanted to play, or Jester, or whoever else I'm play testing with. It's a fantastic tool. I love it.
It really is. I've been doing virtual prototypes. Actually, there's a software called Zunsu, which...
Yes, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, and you kind of have a little... programming thing, but I have a programming background back in the day.
Kind of like Vassal and steroids.
But you actually have to do a little coding.
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm comfortable with that and with the graphic stuff. So I did a prototype. The game before this, actually, you know, I can't bring the science fiction game, but I can bring the World War 85 air game.
Uh-oh.
I just put
another
that,
one for you, Mike.
I just put that prototype into a box because my wife needed the dining room table. But anyway, the prototype before that was in Zunsu. I still have it around. It still works. It's on an earlier version of Windows, but it still works. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's I don't having to do, you know, Vassal's much tougher to get a prototype out of. I need help. I need somebody to do the Vassal module for me.
I've never figured out Vassal. It just doesn't click with my brain. I could never get it to.
I bounced off it pretty hard.
It's very heavy second level programming. Yeah. And anybody who's a programmer knows what I mean by second level. I don't do it for that reason. I just burns my head. It's more about programming and less about the game.
Right.
I need the finish.
So TTS is very accessible. So even, you know, Fred Manzo and I do a lot of playtesting on there, and I'm literally changing things in the game as we're playing.
Oh, you're better than me.
Oh, no. But, you know, like this card is, you know, not worded correctly, and I can go into my Excel file, change it, and blast it into the game, and then we just keep going. It's
right. Fantastic. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can give people a good graphic feel. I mean, I'm not the final artist, but I can give people a good graphic feel for what it's intended to look like. Mm-hmm. And play the game. That's the thing. I'm working on a Starship Troopers style bug hunt game.
Oh, cool. Oh, very,
you know?
Cool.
All right, do you guys remember the original 1977 Starship Troopers from Avalon Hill? Okay, yeah. One of my favorite games, probably Starship Troopers. Well, in the back, they had a diagram that was the drop zones from a level a little bit higher. So you had like the company drop zones and the platoon drop zones. And I always wanted to make a game on that level. And now
that's
I have. And I made it in 1987 and I called it MIDZ, Mobile Adventure Drop Zone. And then I realized, well, I can't really do that. But then I ended up with this science fiction environment and I'm like, oh, I have a spot for this now.
That's great.
I made it like a few months ago and it's in Tabletop Simulator and I'm testing the combat system because I use similar combat systems, but you got to have an intensity level that matches what you're trying to portray. And this might be, I mean, it's good, but there's something that needs to be tweaked, but it's right. To be able to sit there and go, I'm going to drop an entire regiment.
Right.
Yay.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be fun. So it's like, Brent, you didn't know I had all this stuff on the back burner, but
no,
you know.
Apparently not.
I mean, World War 85 has been such a huge project. It's all sitting there. Yeah. It's like, that's what I would do to relax is play my other games.
I have two thoughts. I got, first of all, Herman, you left Fred in New York. You didn't bring him with you. Also, like, joined at the hip.
Yeah. Fred's still back in New York. Yeah.
The second thing, so we do have a copy of the new edition of By Iron and Blood actually on its way to Mike, although he may miss it in the next day or so with having to leave town for a couple days. But
no, he'll have it forwarded, right, Mike?
Well, he'll be back to pick it up before the assembly, but he's by the time the audience is listening to this, Mike should have it in his hands and will probably bring it to get Herman to like teach him how to play.
I will do that. Actually, Steve Jones from Blue Panther will probably have a bunch of them with him.
So that was one thing I did want to mention just real quick, Mike, and I'll let you jump in. Steve from Blue Panther is going to be at the convention. And although we are in the Gamers Armory store. Steve has worked out a deal with the store where he's going to have a bunch of his Blue Panther stuff there for sale available through the store. So you'll buy them through Gamers Armory, but it's the stuff that Steve is bringing with him. The other thing you can do is that if there's something that Blue Panther's got that you want brought with you with him to the to the convention, you probably get in touch with Steve ahead of time and say, hey, I want two of these. Just bring them with you to the fall assembly and I'll pick them up from you there. And I'm sure Steve will accommodate you for that. So, Mike, you were going to jump in there with something.
No, now I just want to say, when Steve arrives, tell him I'll help him carry his inventory into Gamers Armory.
And nothing will go missing, right? And
nothing will go missing.
Exactly.
That'll be like when Gary and I were unloading Enterprise games at Origins, right? You know, I'll take this case full of things here and just hold on to it for safekeeping.
Hey, I have a question. Any magic cards? That's
oh, there you go. Yeah, magic cards—they just come back around. I got into Magic like in the first round, sort of accidentally, because at the time I had a friend who was he worked for like the third largest game distributor in the country at the time, and I was on national tour as an actor, and we ended up in the same city. He's like, "Here, take these." I don't know, 7 booster packs, whatever was just enough cards to be a legal deck. And we started playing Magic on the road. And then the first round of Magic cards sold out. They didn't expect it to sell out. And so we were literally going around the country, stopping at game stores every time we stopped to do a show, going, you know, hey, do you have any Magic cards? And nobody had any until we got to like Seattle. And then you were allowed to buy 2 decks, but that was it because it was so popular. But then we got somewhere in Arizona, there's a game store. It wasn't Phoenix. It must have been, I don't know. But anyway, we got there and they apparently were like the first store to back Magic. And so they had everything because they had the priority store that people that they would, the distributor would send their stuff to. So we walked in like, you mean I can have like 2 decks and 5 booster packs?
Well, I think part of what Herman's referencing are the guys at Gen Con this year that decided to lift a whole pallet of Magic cards.
Oh, I saw that. That was a crime, literally. Wow.
Now
we're hoping Mike doesn't pull off the same shenanigans.
This is simultaneously one of the greatest dumb criminal stories and one of the most inspirational game design stories out there. And that is No. There's these two tie together. These dudes lifted all of those Magic cards while wearing the shirts for their game that they designed and were at Gen Con to promote.
Yep.
So one, these guys were complete morons by making it so easy to figure out who they are. Two, these assholes got a game published. In case you ever wonder whether or not your idea is good enough to get published, these jerks are that stupid and still got something published. You're good. Yep. Whatever your idea is got to be at least good enough to get published by somebody.
And supposedly it was a spontaneous decision on their part to just take the
All right, let me write this down. Do not help Steve while wearing my own Infinity t-shirt.
Who's the guy in the orange coveralls?
Yeah.
So by the time this podcast goes out, Steve will probably also have Viva La Emperor, the second edition. So he's actually publishing that second game that he got from White Dog. So that's the Waterloo game. So he should have some copies of that too.
I'm always up for another one.
All right. So yeah, I bring those with him too.
Yep.
So. Everybody has I have a Waterloo game. It's just, it's sitting in a box.
It's mandatory, right?
I have it. It's a beautiful map, but you know, time to develop it. Oh my God, no.
The 11th season of the Armchair Dragoons podcast, mentioned in dispatches, is graciously supported by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. A huge thank you to Chet Bell, Hellcat6, Patrick Geraghty, Fred Stogg and his walking companion, Mike Quigley, Joseph Knorr, Trep Corey, Stagger Wing, Mark Talk, and Kevin Bertram for their support of the Armchair Dragoons, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming content on the web. You too can sign up as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
So Herman, here's a question for Herman. How many designs on average do you kind of have running in the background that you're actually working on? Not in your head, that you're actually working on at any given moment.
That I physically have files for right now. I got like 7.
Oh God.
Yeah, 7 or 8. Yeah. I have to say, it does. Nancy, my girlfriend, yells at me all the time. She goes, you know, this is turning into real work. I mean, it's like I'm overwhelmed with stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have emails coming in and you're, like you said before, proofreading two or three games at a time. And it's gotten so bad that I don't even answer rules questions on Board Game Geek unless I have to, because I have answered incorrectly many times.
This is the developer designer dynamic. Yeah. I always said Jeff Schulte is my amazing, amazing lead.
Oh, professor. Jeff's great.
Jeff's fantastic. And whenever we're playing, whenever we're playing with someone else, people ask me the rules and I do the rules. He's like, no, that's not right. And Herman, it's like you've got five versions of the rule in your head, but Jeff knows the last one.
Exactly.
So I stay away from Board Game Geek. I let the guys very kindly cover Board Game Geek. I cover, you know, our own Facebook things.
Yeah. So what I usually do,
that's about my bandwidth.
So I subscribe to all my games, obviously. So sure. If I see a rules question pop up, I won't answer it right away. And if it kind of sits out there for a while, I might go in and look it up.
Right. Sometimes on a Sunday when I have an hour, I'll be like,
you know, people don't realize. I don't know if people realize, but like, say, if you're getting, I still get rules questions about At Any Cost, which I designed 10 years ago or something.
Wow.
Like that, right?
Yeah.
Most of the time, we've worked on a game 3 years ago before it ever gets published and out there, and you're already on to something else. And it is tough to keep all the rule sets straight.
It really is.
You know, especially if you're talking about, like, say, my Civil War stuff, which goes from Blind Swords to Black Swan to Shattered Union. They're all variations of each other, and they each have a different, you know, slightly different rule sets, different scales.
I'll get questions sometimes on the videos I do, the playthroughs I do, and it'll be from, you know, years ago. And they'll say, now, in turn four, did you really mean to move the Russian unit 3 hexes?
You need to give me a timestamp for that.
The great thing about YouTube videos is you can do a timestamp for that.
You actually can.
Yeah.
Type the time into your comment so it'll jump to the right place. So that does make it useful. But Mike, there are times where just in terms of clarifying rules, like you've actually read the rule out loud in the middle of your playthrough where you've said, okay, I think this is right. Here's what the rule says. This is what I'm going to do on the map. Because you don't want to stop the game video as you're playing it to like go try and find a clarification. So
yeah, it's more, you know, I'm careful not to call what I do tutorials. It's a kind of a let's learn together type thing. So I will ask questions and I'll encourage people to leave comments. And sometimes the designers will be watching and they'll leave comments. So it's really helpful.
Right.
One of the things when you mentioned the virtual conventions, by the way, I love those virtual conventions. I think I did 3, you know, a game.
Cause you're attending them in flannel lounge pants.
I was not. Wait, it was audio only. Maybe I was. It was audio only. Maybe I was.
You got pants on, you're ahead of the game.
Yeah. But Devin and I would do it as it as a tag team. So he would run the tech. He had the camera and Tabletop Simulator that people were actually watching. I could have whatever camera I wanted because Tabletop Simulator separates them. But, you know, he could look up rules if there was an issue, or I could look up rules if he was talking at the same time. So having that teamwork really worked out well for that. But yeah, a lot of fun doing that. Really did.
And you can also drink bourbon while you're doing that. So that works out even better.
Drinking and wargaming. There's a lot of people who drink whiskey and bourbon and everything. And I'm not a drinker for various and sundry reasons. You know, I don't. A lot of my friends are huge whiskey fanatics. You know, they'll go
I'm to a party big bourbon night. Guy right here. That's there one of the. One of the advantages of moving to Tennessee, you get into bourbon very quickly.
Oh, there you go. There you go. But I have this aromatic sense of it, where it's, you know, like friends had like a party, they had like 9 different whiskeys opened, and I smell them all, and they all smell different, and they're all very nice.
Yeah.
So I can participate that way. But, you know, when gaming, I'm like, I get a little too intense. I'm like, if I were drinking, that would not be a good thing. Are you an angry gamer? A sleepy gamer?
Well, Keith, you mentioned the digital conventions with sort of the broadcast piece that we do. And that is something that we've made it a point with all the digital conventions to make sure that we do is as much as possible, we want people live streaming their games, because while the digital convention is never going to completely replicate the in-person experience, one of the things we want people to be able to do is sort of click through the different channels in the Discord and be able to observe what other people are playing. That's kind of the digital equivalent of walking around the convention and just looking over people's shoulders at the table and being able to say, oh, that looks cool. What are you guys doing? What are y'all working on?
And yeah, I got to pop in on Volco doing a demo of what's the American Revolution coin game? I'm sorry. There's so many coin games. I can't get them straight.
Liberty or Death,
which was really cool.
Keith, Keith, you are coming down primarily with World of War 85 stuff. And so I think we've only got two things on the schedule for you. We've got kind of a learning game and then sort of the big battle royale rumble game on the schedule, right?
Yeah. I'm going to do two learning games at the same time. So I'm sort of going to like have people sit down, have a couple of pairs play. I'm trying to decide whether to do Storming the Gap, which is also the title scenario, which is a great learning scenario, or whether to substitute some different forces in the same proportion. Mm-hmm. So to use some of the other forces. But some people might be disappointed that they don't have M1 Abrams. So maybe we won't do that. We'll ask them. It's like, do you want to use it? You know, do you want to use the Czechs? Yeah. You want to use the T-55 AM2s? Because Devin would say yes, because he loves playing the Czechs, because the Czech maps, Czechoslovakia is just heavily wooded. So he drives his tanks like right in the face of the infantry and he assaults everything. He just does. Yeah, he's like, and he wins. It's like, okay. So I'm going to do that. And then the big game is going to be, I'm going to do a 4-mapper. It's not the 8-mapper. The 8-mapper, you can't do in 4 hours. But I'm going to take one of the scenarios that's set up for 4 maps and have a lot of forces. But mm-hmm. we'll have a 4-map game and then we'll run it about 4 hours and see how far we get. So, but now that you put the bug in my bonnet, I can bring down the latest iteration of the World of War 85 squadron level operational air game. So this is...
No, please don't bring cool stuff.
Because, I mean, part of me wanted to play, what is it, It Never Snows?
Right. I'm a big, do it. I mean, it's split.
I'm a huge Market Garden fan. I mean, who isn't? But yeah, I'm a huge Market Garden. But this
the
air
one
game
Keith's
really
referencing, just sidebar real quick, the one Keith's referencing is we've got It Never Snows set up for Saturday to run all day in two separate sessions. So we're gonna play the full like 5-map Market Garden game where Voss, the way he's got it set up is he's got separate player roles for 30 Corps, for the airborne, for the U.S. airborne, for the British airborne, for several different German commanders. So he'll be able to absorb multiple players who may want to jump in there. And you're not committed to like 10 hours worth of game. You can play just half the scenario if you want.
Right.
How big is this game store?
The pictures, it has some pretty big tables.
Yeah.
So the pictures are linked over on the site because we've done the game store as part of the FLGS Spotlight series in the past. But it's the space they're in used to be a pizza joint. And the front third, you know, between 30% and 40% is all game racks and the game racks that they have, the vast majority of them are on wheels. There's a handful of things attached to the wall. The rest of them are all wire shelf racks that are on wheels so they can reconfigure things really quickly. And the whole back end of the store is all game table space that's probably got between 18 and 20 tables in there. We're going to push a couple of them together as double-sized tables. When they do their charity fundraiser in November every year, that's the 24-hour Board Games for a Cure Marathon, they'll have 180 to 200 people in there over the course of the night, all sitting down playing stuff. Now that's a lot of things that you can put a bunch of stuff on smaller tables pretty easily. They're not war game size footprints. But I mean, we've got two full banquet tables plus an extender for the start of the 30 Corps approach march that are all going to be put together on a one big table in the back. That we've got a pretty good chunk of space to work with. I mean, we wouldn't be holding the convention in the game store if we were going to be like elbow to elbow between the shelves. I mean, we've got a good amount of play space in the back, and that area actually has a couch back there also you can kind of hang out on.
I can't wait to see this place.
And then I have to find time to play Zorn. Because I'm a huge I want to play a war game, I don't care what it's on, fan. Come on, Melee, Wizard, The Fantasy Trip, the original war games, you know, that came from role-playing games but actually worked as war games.
Right. You mentioned bringing some extra stuff. I mean, one of the things that we intentionally did, we had sort of capped, in the back of our minds when Mike and I were talking about setting all this stuff up, we had capped the amount of hours we wanted filled with scheduled events. At a certain point, we wanted it to be about 50% of the available table hours because we wanted to leave plenty of open space for some for pickup gaming in between, especially because we're going to be in the game store, right? You're going to go buy the cool new thing that you see on the shelf and you're going to be like, man, I want to open this right away and start playing. And so we wanted people to be able to do that. I think we ended up with about 40% of the available table hours filled with something scheduled. Mm-hmm. And there's one extended table, long skinny table set up that we've been able to keep no scheduled events from being scheduled on that one. So we've got one full table that will always be open for pickup stuff.
Well, it's good planning on your part, because that's one of the things I was thinking about. When I'm not running the demo, what do I do, right? Is there any place else to go and just set up a game?
Oh, yeah. And, no, that was intentional.
Yeah, good. Well, good job.
So I've been lobbying. I've been lobbying for him to do that at Origins. So hopefully we'll do that at Origins too.
The challenge we tried that at Origins 1 year and it didn't work out quite as well as we'd hoped. Herman actually brought one of the things that it might have been the most fearful sacrifice, because it was like 2015, 2016 when you were working on that one way back when.
Oh, I think it was Long Street Attacks. It might have been.
It could have been.
Yeah.
It could have been. It was one of the Civil War ones for sure.
Yep.
But the challenge we run into there, Mike, is dealing with the Origins hierarchy. They don't like to have loose tables just floating around that don't have scheduled and planned and dedicated to it. So we're going to see if we can try and pull something off this year. But we'll have to, I mean, you were there for the conversations at the end of Origins this year. Like, we've got GMs coming out the woodwork wanting to come do stuff with us that we're doubling the amount of space that we had, and pretty much all those tables are accounted for. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Herman, you saw how much space we had this year and it was packed.
Yeah. You had everybody doubling that footprint in there. Yep.
For the next year, the space that was across the long curtain from us, kind of behind the monitor that we were using for the CPXs.
That's because you got Art Wolf running those monitor games over there.
Gary and Lee. Well, I mean, Lee is the guy that does most of the heavy lifting on that. Gary's the loud one, but Lee's the guy doing all the work. They set up and run one game for 4.5 days of, they break it into 4-hour blocks so that nobody's stuck sitting there for, 24 hours worth of game session.
Gary's such a great guy, Art Wolf. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
He is one of the smartest guys I've ever talked to. He knows the hobby backwards and forwards, and he's just a nice guy and a smart guy, too. He's good for the hobby.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a blast. He's a blast. Yep. He's a ton of fun, which is why we keep bringing him back to the podcast with us.
Oh, yeah. He should really get his own show.
Funny. I know this guy. His name is Arvel Fazell. Is that, somebody's got his show already.
I was watching him last night. He had 100 something people on his live show.
Nice. Yeah,
that's nice.
God. That's awesome. Yeah.
120 is actually a little low for him. He's usually closer to about 160 for most of his.
If I had 160 people in my living room for my podcast for an hour, that's pretty impressive.
I did grab the screen cap and I had shared it out through our social channels when Mark Herman chimed in and said, Gary, you're a bad influence. I'm now drinking scotch and clipping counters.
Wait, that's even more dangerous. Yeah. now you got a blade.
Well, but when Mark Herman's chiming in about you being a bad influence on him, I made sure to screen cap that for Gary. And
he's probably absolutely
printed it and framed it at this point. So. Keith, you mentioned some of the stuff Herman's got, and also It Never Snows. Was there anything else on the schedule that somebody else was bringing that caught your eye?
Check
that out.
There were, but I apologize. I don't remember. There's always something. There's always something. I apologize. I can't contribute any material right here, because I was going to go back through it. because I'm sorry about it. And now you got me going, bringing the air game, which, like I said, is pretty much half packed up.
You're not running multiple monitors where you can just have the schedule on the side monitor for you?
No, I'm probably the only person in the world who, I have my Mac here, but I only have one screen here. I mean, for my work thing here, I have three screens, and work, I have three screens. I only have one.
Herman, have you seen the rest of the schedule? Have you checked out?
That's
some
funny, because I had the exact same answer.
I'm sorry.
No, because you're so focused on, well, what I have to run, I can't be looking at anything else because I'm going to get distracted.
Right, right. I'm thinking, how do I pack up two sets of games for the first scenario? Do I need to bring two whole games?
Right. So at conventions, I'm kind of a wanderer. I don't like to schedule things. I kind of like to wander around.
Yeah. See who I
run into, talk to people. And if there's somebody says, hey, do you want to join us? I'll join you.
I mean, that's what I like about when you describe the store. It's like it's like walking around and looking over people's shoulders, but it's all right there within 50 feet. That's the best part.
Right. It's not like at Origins where you got to walk 2 miles.
Yeah, walk 2 miles to get your hot dog and then 2 miles back to go see the next game. Right.
So it's a nice experience.
You've got a couple of players you can draft into your Triumph and Tragedy games.
Well, no, if we have open slots, we're going to play something different.
Yeah, the one thing I had to make sure of for me is that I didn't want to overschedule myself so that I was available to like help put out fires or if there's any problems somewhere along the way to help sort those out. So I've got brief border wars for one session and that's it. That's because it's one that I've done a lot at conventions. I know it well enough to do it very quickly and easily. And it's one that I can, out of one box, I can get two simultaneous games going. So it's very easy to throw out there and crank up and go. So the rest of the time, like I may be hopping in as a filler to, you know, balance out somebody else's or just hop in a pickup game or make Keith put the World at War squadron based air game on the table or something.
So. You don't have to force me.
Well, the two questions I have for you, Brant, are two typical old fart questions.
Oh, boy.
Where do you park and how's the bathroom situation?
Right.
Look, again, it used to be a pizza joint, so the bathroom situation is fine.
Oh, there you go.
And it's right there with us. And there's actually a pretty good sized parking lot right outside awesome. Us. The one challenge you run into with Gamer's Armory is it's not the easiest thing to see from the road because it's behind there's a fire station in the building that's right up at the road. So as long as you know to look behind the fire station, you're fine. But you can't really see it from the road because of that. The shopping center that it's in, it's down at one end of the shopping center, but the shopping center is built into a hill. So the lower level where Gamer's Armory is, there's like a trophy store and a kung fu studio and a dance studio or whatever right there along with it. But
so wait a minute. We got the fire department to put out fires. We got the kung fu studio to help protect.
Yep. And we've got a trophy
and
studio.
We can dance if we feel happy, you know?
The game. And it's built into the wall, so it's built into the hill, so it's effectively a pillbox.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, it is. The challenge is from the back of the store, you get lousy Wi-Fi coverage. But there's a gym up above, so every once in a while, you hear somebody who had a failure to spot.
This odd grunting.
Been there, heard that.
You don't really hear like the grunting or the you know, the workout bros hitting on chicks or anything. What you do hear is the occasional clang of somebody who tried to lift just a little too much.
Yeah, a little bit too much. Yeah.
Went for 175.
Yeah.
but there's plenty of good eats around us and there's some lousy fast food around us as well. Mm. And parking is not an issue. And for the attendees, we're actually gonna be sending out some information on parking and travel and access and getting in and out of there. And part of what I want to make sure we do with the parking is because most of our folks are going to be there all day is that we park a little further away from the building to make it easier for the people that are just coming in to grab something and get back out that they can have those spots right up against the building a little easier.
Yep. Right. So, yeah, we want Steve to back up right to the door so I can help him unload.
Mike's well, got it. Logistics.
Yeah. Right. I'm going to get over there Friday around, you know, between 10 and noon and unload the stuff that I need for setting up for like the table signs and those kinds of things. And anybody who's seen our setup at Origins knows the kinds of stuff we're talking about, but it's not going to be quite that elaborate. And so I'll pull up, I'll unload the box right there by the door and roll it in, and then I'll go move my car. This won't mean as much to Keith and Herman who don't know the guy. Mike knows Michael from the Dragoons, Banzai Cat, Michael Eckenfels, who's one of our writers, is actually flying in from Memphis. He had some airline miles that he's burning. And he's staying in a hotel right down the street from the convention. But to save him on the rental car, I'm his ride. So I'm going to pick him up and take him back each day. Because it's not like we're gallivanting around town, right? I'm going to pick him up at the hotel. We're going to the game store. We're going to be there for 14, 16 hours, whatever. Then I'm going to drop him off on my way home. Mm-hmm. And so I'll have extra people with us. But yeah, we've actually got folks flying in from the left coast to be a part of this, which is kind of cool.
That's impressive.
I'm taking the train.
Folks, it's kind of folks singular, right? It's...
It's the one dude. Folk. It's a folk.
It is a folk. Keith, you'd mentioned sci-fi game universe thing. Is that Space Infantry universe or is that something different? Is this the Falling Stars universe?
No, it's not a lock and load universe. It's my personal.
It's your
universe. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
A friend of mine worked on it in high school. It was his. He passed away about, 16 years ago.
Wow.
And he had given it to me because he's like, you do the Terrans. Like, okay. Because he did the aliens. And I didn't feel right using exact his aliens. That's the background. And eventually I might, because he did actually give it to me. But I'm like, let me make a new one just so it's, you know.
I thought maybe it was something that you had sold the lock and load and you were the guy honchoing.
No. This is not something that's going to get sold. This is something that I will take pieces of and develop.
Gotcha.
So, you know, the Starship Troopers homage game is from that. My son is a screenwriter, so I had him actually co-opted him to write a military, you know, like the blurb in the front of the thing. In the front of the rules to say, you know, this is this piece of the Terran Procyonese war,
right?
The war between the spiral arms.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because design wise, you can do whatever you want, right? Mm-hmm. So you can have a lot of fun, yet you still have to have an internal consistency in your universe, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
That little blurb that in the front actually is really important.
Mm-hmm.
It ties in all your aspects of your design, right?
Yes. So
even with a sci-fi or a horror game or a fantasy game, you still have to have an internal logic and consistency.
Continuity.
Yeah, it's got to make sense, you know?
Yeah.
What I call the ground science fiction game, because it's a science fiction siege, and it is actually related to, there's a lot of history in this game that's not formalized because I'm not a writer, but I know the history of certain portions, and you only need so much history to make a game. Mm-hmm. But this is complete. It's like two spiral arms worth of battles, and I have a map, and I have multiple maps, and you know, I had a game I wrote on that before, a spacecraft miniatures game, which at some point I will be redoing. So if you all the ideas come out, you got to focus on the one that actually makes a game. So the ground combat game was the siege of Midpoint Station. And it turned out when I made the map that it was four regular maps. And I'm like, oh boy, that's big. So, well, I could actually do this as four games with one map and a reasonable number of counters for each. And then you can put the four games together if you want to buy all four.
Right.
Because doing a giant monster game, I think is kind of beyond me. And anyway. But you end up, you know, we go back to you have to write the internally consistent thing. Well, artillery in a science fiction environment, people are like, well, you have to have a line of sight. I'm like, no, you don't.
No, you don't.
You've got smart missiles. You've got, you know, trackers, you've got drones, exactly, you got whatever. Right. But what you do have in this particular one, and this is totally inspired by Warhammer 40K. There was one of the Gaunt's Ghost books, which if people know the Gaunt's Ghost books, the Siege of Vervenhive, and the city had a shield over it.
Mm-hmm.
But as the enemy gets into the walls, the shield bends around them, basically. It actually breaks in Vervenhive, but I have a different way of doing it. So the easy way to do it rules-wise is to say, I can target anything that's within one hex outside of the shield, but the shield collapses as the enemy goes in.
Mm.
So it keeps it simple, keeps it clean. But yeah, there's no line of sight. If you've got something available, you can fire as long as it's within range. There's range for some things, but for the really big guns on the tower in the middle, there's no range.
and having no line of sight is just wonderful, isn't it?
It's a dream come true.
The worst section of that rule book for any historical war game is the damn sight rules, man.
I can tell you for World War 85, it was, you know, making the map work properly with the numbers, doing the, and it's a basic triangular line of sight system, but it works.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that's the, you know, even with that, there's like a million diagrams to show.
You're
at that level, you're at the next level up.
And that's the way I did it with Blind Swords. I said, look, screw all this blind zone and this gun. Here we're going to go, are you higher than the target, lower than the target, or the same as the target? And
right,
we're going to go off of that.
That's right, it's a beautiful thing, it really is. I mean you probably remember the Gettysburg 77 that had three different versions, and the advanced version had a height for every hex. There was like a second black and white map that had the hex heights, and you had to actually do the math, and I'm like, this is nice.
I do math for a living all day long. I'm not doing math in my hobby.
My condolences, you know. It's
okay. Yeah.
That, at that point, you're doing work. You're not playing games.
Right.
Exactly.
That's more than I want to mess with.
Yep.
Mike's busy trying to figure out how he can work in a Star Trek comment on the whole intro.
No. No more Star Trek comments because of the continuity problems we were talking about earlier.
Oh, yes.
Really? Did they get pushback on that?
from Mike.
I don't know, years ago I had my friends, because I have a role-playing game, and I should say role-playing system, but it adapts to any genre. Just a segue for half a second, guys, I know you're wargamers, but you know, back when the white box of D&D came out, we were all wargamers, and we went, wow, what's this? And we've been playing them side by side ever since. So my friends were like, you know, we've never played in a Star Trek game that we liked, and that wasn't totally true. We had a friend who ran an amazing game, but there was something that else that they were looking to get. I'm like, well, I'll run a test for you.
Okay.
And the first thing that happened was, you know, they were happy to find out that, like, they could be anything they want. Mm-hmm. Like, can I have a ship? Like, yeah, you can have a ship, but you have to populate the crew. I'm not going to do that for you. Like, you mean I get to like tell you who my first officer is? Yeah. And then you need their background. And they were like, you mean I get a ship? And every one of them had a ship because everybody wants to be the captain. They don't want to be the bridge crew sometimes. Right. Sometimes right. you do. Sometimes you do. It works really well for cooperative games. But there were a lot of these guys, I think, were they wanted to have their own ship. And they did that. And they really enjoyed it. It was 3 hours. It was fantastic. And I still remember it. And it was like 30 years ago. So there's your Star Trek reference.
So for historical games, you don't have to worry about all the background, obviously, right?
Right. I mean, you have to then you have to find the background.
Right. You have to find it. So for, let's say, Struggle for Zorn. So I have this idea for, well, we're each going to, each person is going to be a house of the kingdom. And we have our own faction, right? And we have all been gathered together to defeat the Red Blight, which is this evil entity that has come down and taken over this province. So one, I have that, right?
Right.
You still need that. Okay, we need to develop a history of what's Zorn, who's the Red Blight, why'd they come in,
right?
What do these houses represent? Who else is in this kingdom that could show up all of a sudden? You know, this this whole story tie-in now is another aspect to, well, it's fun to design, but now I have to a different design problem, right? I have to come up. I'm not that good at coming up with. I can come up with simple stuff, but coming up with a real overarching, entertaining story to go with all this. So we actually had to have somebody else kind of.
Yeah, that's a literary project. You need a writer. And I think that's what some people may not realize is, you know, if you design a game on your own and, you know, there's multiple designers we know that do all their own stuff, but they hand it off to a developer who's working with a publisher who has other resources to rewrite that stuff, or maybe they rewrite it themselves. Nobody has a huge staff in war game companies. They just don't. Yeah, right. That's why it's a niche industry, is it's small publishing. But so, you gotta have, I found I had to have writers. You know, we needed voice talent, which I am voice talent, so it was easy to find for some things. For you know, like the original Kickstarter for Storming the Gap, we needed somebody to do the voice for the news thing in the background. And then so I think David found somebody, but then I did like the audiobook for it.
Right.
So you need all these different pieces now that you didn't need before. I was listening to a podcast a little earlier tonight, and the guy's like, you know, the beautiful graphics and the, you know, the beautiful rule books and this and that, that's all become the standard, you know, get on the stick, guys. And I'm like, do you know how much that costs?
Right.
Because now you're in the world of, it's big enough that it needs specialists.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting with World at War is you have a historical reference point, right? You have real armies.
Yes.
But what you're simulating didn't happen. So that's fantasy.
Yes. Quote unquote, it is. Fantasy, absolutely. Right? It is.
And so you've got real world research to do, but you still need somebody to write the fiction.
Yes. And we still have arguments about the French would never do that. Nicholas and I back and forth.
Right.
And in the end, I'm like, you know, Nicholas and I are great friends, is like, but he's always saying, you know, that was his thing, was the French would not do A, B, or C. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, he's French. He has French sources. I think I need to yield. Much as in my head for the series, I'm like, no, we're going to Paris. He's like, no, there would be nukes before that. And I'm like, and it's a different perspective between Europeans who play the game and Americans who play the game, but there you go. But you write your own Red Storm Rising is how I describe it.
Exactly.
Right. You're writing your Third World War. And of course, what am I reading? What do I got behind me? First Clash, about the Canadians, and, you know, the chieftains, about the British. And there's one of my favorites that probably led me to this, Red Army, by Ralph Peters. Mm-hmm. Brilliant book. And you're reading that and you're going, wait, NATO loses. And having played nothing but the Soviets in tactical games in MBT and whatever it was, because nobody wanted to play the Soviets.
Right, of course, right.
I learned how to lose first. I lost a lot. And then when I finally figured out how to win, you're like, oh, well, maybe I should bring this joy to other people. But then we went back to, you know, World of War specifically, we went back to the metrics and found it was closer than it looked, at least according to what we were doing. And of course, I'm a civilian, you know, I've been reading military history since I was a kid.
Me too.
You know, I happened to run into some wonderful people, you know, who either are still in the military or were in the military, and bounce these ideas off of them and go, does this make sense? And when you get to the point where they're like not really answering you, you realize it's probably classified. And at that point, you're like, it's very freeing. You're like, that means I can choose whatever I want because nobody could gainsay me because they're not allowed to.
I will say in their defense, because this does apply to some of the stuff I dealt with in the military as well. There were things that I had dealt with back in the 90s that were in fact classified. Yeah. I have no idea if they're still classified. I'm still not talking about them. I'm not taking the chance.
I suspect that the statistics for the Soviet 125 millimeter smoothbore are still classified. I really do. And I'm not going to test it. I don't care. All I know is I could only get so far. Right. And then it was like, I will pick another. We literally got to the point where the design team got together and like, we need a range.
Yeah.
And I said, does this sound reasonable? And Jeff pipes up with a number. And nobody else said anything. It was crickets. I'm like, okay, that's it. Because all the metrics said it was more and we had to make it a little less. And it's a game. You know, yeah. You make your best call with the information you have.
Yeah.
When the expert shows up who actually was there and used these weapons, it's like, yeah, but are you allowed to tell us about them?
Right.
There was a story, I think, the old PC game, I think I remember this correctly, is F-19 Stealth Fighter.
Oh, my God.
Released before they actually released the F-19 Stealth Fighter. And I thought, they questioned this game company because they're like, where did you get this from? Where's this information coming from? And they were just, you know, like you're saying, they were just, well, I'm just going to do this. This makes the most sense. And then they go...
right. But I mean, sometimes you get lucky in it. But Herman, it's like when you're doing Civil War stuff.
Yeah.
It's a whole different process, right? I mean, it's that three different sources thing. But how do you make your choice when you have like three different sources that say?
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. I've literally sat here at this with books spread out all around me here on this table behind me.
For the audience at home, Herman's gesturing to a table.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Insert video.
I'm so used to doing these live podcasts. I forget.
Right.
And, you know, I got to be honest with you, it's tough. Sometimes you just have to say, well, you know, where's the weight coming, right? But then somebody might, even on the minority side, might make a really valid point and support it better than right? So you just take all of it and you go, well, what makes sense? And then sometimes you just have to say, well, what works for the game, right? Like game-wise, where would I want these guys to come in if you can't get a really solid answer? Yeah, it's tough sometimes. And it's surprising that even with a battle like Gettysburg, you still get the battery was here or the battery was a mile away. And a lot of it's very fuzzy, right? You know, like they arrived at some town at 5 a.m., then they show up at another ridge at 8, and you're like, well, okay, where were they in between? How long were they there? You know, that guy, is that on the map? Is it not on the map? It's a lot of guesswork. I gotta admit it.
But mostly, in my mind, I don't mind that guesswork on the part of the designer because when I'm playing the game, I'm not a reenactor, right? I'm not trying to follow a script of this is exactly what happened. And so when you start talking about here's where this unit should come in on the map, at a certain point. As a designer, you're going to kind of zoom out a little bit and go, okay, why are they coming in at that point on the map? Well, that's the only road that leads anywhere. You know, there's only one road that comes into this whole side of the map because there's a river on one side and a cliff on the other. And like, that's literally the only place they could come in, even though the rest of that stuff isn't on the map.
But depending on what scenario you're doing, you just need to find out, well, when did they enter the battle arena?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And after that, I don't have to worry about it because the player's going to move them to wherever they're going to move them. After that.
Yeah. I mean, any war game to my mind, and I think somebody may have said this, I'm stealing it, but is an exercise in alternate reality because you can set up where they were, but as soon as the first unit moves, it's not the same.
Yeah. I've said that, man. As soon as you roll that first die, you're playing a fantasy game.
It's chaos theory. You don't know where you're going to start. You don't know where you're going to end, but roughly you're going to start and end in the same place.
Right.
You know, I'll also say that like with things like the Gettysburgs and Waterloos of the world for me. And again, we're talking some games that I don't play a ton of because the Age of Gunpowder stuff isn't something that I'm all that into and Mike just died a little inside when I said that, but
that's all right, Mike, we're behind you.
but
we'll straighten him out when we get to North Carolina.
I don't necessarily want Gettysburg to start with everybody already on Cemetery Ridge and Little Round Top. And, you know, the Confederates are necessarily in the same historical lines they started with on the morning of the first. What if the approach march was different? What if the Confederates did overload the left flank or the right flank? Or what if the 20th Maine got lost on their way to Little Round Top? And now somebody's got to stretch a little further to occupy it. Like, to me, so many of the games, you know, Herman, you go back into the designers want to show off that meticulous detail of their research. And it's great that they did all that research. But at a certain point, if I'm exploring the what ifs, I want to back up an extra step before the actual setup on the morning of the battle. What could have been different?
Right.
These guys have ended up in the wrong place or got lost in the dark, because Lord knows that never happens. You know,
And you do that by offering
isn't historical.
Right. And you do that by offering multiple scenarios. So we have the little, you know, exact scenarios at Little Round Top, at here, Pickett's Charge, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And then at the end, I have multiple scenarios where you can use the historical reinforcement schedules, or you can come up with your own reinforcement schedules and come into different parts of the map, you know, variations of the historical narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, you can do whatever you want. Look, that is a bugaboo of mine for the longest time. I always use the Bulge as an example of, you know, guys say, well, I want a Battle of the Bulge game. Okay, well, here, I'm going to design this Battle of the Bulge game. And, oh, we played it and the Germans won. Well, this is unrealistic.
You wanted a simulation.
Right. You want a simulation of the Battle of the Bulge. Okay, right. You don't want a game on the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah.
Right. And, yeah, definitely.
I still have Attack of the Ardennes, that zone game that my son and I used to play when he was young, sitting in a box back here. Right. It's a great game.
I mean, to me, you know, the exploring the what ifs, you know, Herman, you're right. Like, as soon as you roll the first die after the setup, you're in the realm of alternate reality, which I think is what we all want. We all want that level of freedom to change what happened on the battlefield, and no disagreement there at all. To me, I almost want to back up an extra step. And like you said, like it you bring that in through multiple scenarios. I want the, you know, what if somebody got lost in the dark? What if somebody pushed their troops a little harder to show up earlier? Right. What if, you know, somebody, you know, flip-flopped where people were set up on, you know, the left versus right flank, or whatever it might be, you know?
This goes all the way down to how do you rate commanders and units, right? Yeah.
Commanders and units.
Yes.
Oh, I got a book on that judgment. One.
Well, did this unit have, was it an average unit that just had a particularly good day and made its die rolls at Gettysburg? Or is it really a better unit? Was this commander just having a crappy day, or was he having a great day, right?
And there are times where the historical result was the double six, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
I mean, look at Rourke's Drift.
You know, the 20th Maine made all its die rolls. I mean, I don't know what to tell
Look at Rourke's Drift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
there's no
look
way
at the odds there.
Yeah. The Colonial should not have won Cowpens. Yeah.
I think my games are a little more fantasy than other games. I have a Gettysburg game too. and then I started playing Herman. I have an admission to make. Did you ever see Iron Chef?
Of course, yes.
So there was one where Bobby Flay was up against one of the classic Iron Chefs who'd come from the early original series, the Japanese guy. And the Japanese guy makes a smoker out of ice. And Bobby Flay turns around and sees it. When he realizes what it is, he goes, "I'm going home." So this was my feeling when I started playing your Civil War games, because I'm like, this is my game concepts, but it's so elegant. I could never come up with it. I do mean that as a compliment, but it's
very nice of you to say.
It's you know, the way that combat varies, and you know, for me the concept is, and this doesn't apply to your game, I'm saying, but for my games, are like the smallest, weakest unit has to have a chance to beat the largest, best unit.
It does,
because history gives those, and it's not. And somebody say, well, the odds are against that if you count the number of battles. I'm like, yeah, you do, and the odds are like one in a gazillion that Rourke's Drift would have been a win for the British just by the numbers, but they won. How do you count for that?
Exactly.
Everybody wants one Rourke's Drift. You know, if the scale is right for, you know, or one bulge thing where, you know, you're fighting off a Bastogne, you know, everybody wants that to happen once in their game because that's the narrative they want to tell.
Right.
You know, war games, despite the people who play for metrics, it's about the story afterwards. That, I'm convinced.
That's exactly right. And that's why I designed Blind Swords, because like you said before, we've both, and most probably all of us have been military historians since I remember reading books, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And I was a war gamer and a miniature player for many, many years. And the one thing that kept bugging me was that the war games devolved down into a math contest, right? It's that famous meme of Hindenburg looking over the map and going, I'm trying to get 4-1 odds here. I need one more factor, right? And
he's looking, yeah, what about the 2-1 at Tobruk? You know,
yeah, exactly. That always drove me batty that the game had devolved down to that, because I had read all this great, flowery, wonderful history of impossible defenses and doomed attacks. And I just tried to build that narrative into my games. I don't know if I would say accidentally or whatever, but people say, wow, this is realistic.
Yeah, it feels real. It feels like, and that's what I go for in my designs. It needs to feel real. And the way it feels real is in real life, those kind of things happen all the time in our lives. And people just don't notice them.
Battlefields are chaos.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Right. So, you know, I've played, you know, when I play my games and this is just me telling me when, like this air game, I sat there and played it. I've been playing it for weeks and I finally she clean it up. I'm like, well, the Russians are running out of planes anyway. but the gut feeling of I'm the NATO air command and I'm responding to waves of Soviet planes, which is what you don't get in any other game, which is why I want to develop this thing. Waves of Soviet planes. So the initiative is what do they call it when it's initiative is not balanced? I forget what that is. I should know. I'm using it. But anyway, it's like you roll 2d10 for the Soviets to get an initiative number and 1 for NATO, because it's not the direct initiative that you'd think. That's just kind of a who goes first, and the Soviets are going to tend to do that. What in the game, what you do is you put flights up into stacks, basically, like Luftwaffe.
I remember that. Yep.
But you put them up there, and then NATO's going to see these stacks appearing, and then you're like, you know, you're going second, and a lot of people have arguments with initiative and who goes first and second. And I'm like, if you have the initiative, you drive the action, so you go first. Mm-hmm. But then he gets to see where I go. He's reacting to you. Yeah. So if you're the Soviets and you have waves of plane, that's the point. So you see these waves. And NATO kind of goes, I'm going to throw my F-15s at him. And he's got like 12 MiG-23 regiments. What do I have? I have 3 F-15 squadrons in all of Europe in 1985.
Yeah.
I have more F-16s. I have Belgian F-16s. I have Netherlands F-16s. Okay. So you start to build the combined arms force, and it's a whole different feel than anything else I've ever played. I'm trying to address the issues of Luftwaffe. I'm trying to address the issues of every World War III game that has the line them up in a box. And I like the line them up in the box for these games, but line them up in the box, squadron versus squadron. I remember playing Third World War and had the F-15s, and they just wiped everything else. If you didn't kill the Soviet Air Force by the end of turn two, you weren't working hard enough, or the dice were against you. But to have this feel of...
actually counted the number of air-to-air missiles that all those F-15s carry, and then finally did the math and went, oh, shit, they don't have enough to actually shoot down everything that they theoretically shot down.
Yeah, so the first time I played and I sent out my major NATO strike to oppose a major Soviet sweep, and I lost an F-15, I'm like, oh... I like to have people feel like they have to fight these things that they think are wonder weapons. Mm-hmm. But when there's only three of them, you have to fight it. You have to know where to use it, when to use it, why to use it. It's Kenny Rogers, you know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
Right.
You know, when to walk away and know when to run. You know, take that F-15 and turn tail and run. And you look at the Top Gun exercises, you know, F-15s versus F-5s. Well, now you're going to have F-15s versus MiG-21s. And if that MiG-21 shoots down an F-15 and somebody says it's unrealistic, I'll say, go talk about Top Gun. But this, I want people to have the same like gut-wrenching, am I going to get through this turn? There's so many Russian planes. Right. And the Soviets are kind of going, I have so many planes and they keep shooting me down. I want that both sides feel like they're losing.
Right.
That's weird, but.
Oh, that's a good point. Having both players thinking they're losing it means you've done something right.
But to go back to your Civil War system, it's like and my Civil War system is like, it was all about the variable march rates for movement. I did a lot of research into just how far and how fast troops moved
Yeah.
And how did they do column of fours, you know?
Right.
And how close they were for combat. Patty Griffith has a fantastic book, Civil War Tactics.
I have that.
And
one. Yep.
And the thing that it points out is on average, the average distance of a Civil War combat with these rifles that could shoot 1,000 yards was 400 yards. Mm-hmm. So I set my hex scale to 400 yards and right. suddenly the game opened up
right.
in terms of combat wise. And then having the variable march rate, that's where yours is so elegant. And mine is like, I've got an effort level for each core. It's just, it's too many tracks. Too many to track. So I'm not getting that done anytime soon. Yeah. But the intent is there of, you know, if the scale's right. So I say to people in these podcasts, is like, if the scale is right, the combat takes care of itself.
Right.
You know, somebody's like, well, do you have special? And I love the charge rules in like, you know, all the Napoleonic games and everything. I don't feel they're necessary in my own game. So in my Napoleon, yeah. in my Waterloo game, it's like, well, yeah, they move 6 and infantry move 3. And those are based on approach rates that I've read about, you know, the research I've done about approach rates when you're actually marching toward the enemy mm-hmm. in, you know, a line instead of marching in column, French aside. But the cavalry is like, well, do you have special rules for how the cavalry attack? I'm like, no, once they're adjacent, that's just how they attack. Mm-hmm. You know, they start about 200, 300, 400 yards out, which is within the hex, and they attack. They just, right. they're faster getting there. So they have a movement of 6. Trying to distill it down to the basic decisions based off of scale seems to help the intensity level. It's,
right.
it takes care of itself in a lot of ways.
And I don't think a lot of people appreciate how confusing a battlefield actually is, right? Mm. So I'm working on Chickamauga now, and they literally, when you mm. use the term march to the sound of the guns, they literally had to do that
yeah.
because it was so dense and so smoky and dusty that nobody knew where anything was. And that's one of the really eye-opening things. Fred Manzo went to a lecture by John Priest, who authored one of the books that I have used for Most Fearful Sacrifice. And he made a great point. And that's why a lot of the stuff that I put in my game is in there. He says, people don't realize the buildup of smoke on a battlefield in 1863 over the course of 3 days, that by the time you're done, you're halfway through that second day, there is total chaos, smoke. Nobody knows where anything is.
What's going on?
It's just total chaos. Nobody can see anything. And when I heard that, I was like, God damn, that's right. We're thinking about modern times and all. Back then in that smoke and powder era, that's all residual effects that are on that battlefield that the soldiers had to deal with, the commanders had to deal with.
Did they even have smokeless powder that far back?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. So figure the first volley, now you're concealed.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, friendly fire was a big thing. Chickamauga is less like, oh my God, like that battle.
Trees. Just for the trees.
Oh yeah. That battle is built for blind swords because it is chaos. They don't even know where each other's flanks are. They're just running into each other. And like you said, in the forest, it's amazing. And then you got the famous, you know, brigade that got moved out of the line as Longstreet's about to attack.
Yeah.
The whole brigade got moved out of the line.
Like, where are you going? We were ordered here.
Yes.
And you left a hole and Longstreet poured through it.
Right. And what war game? Well, again, the question is, what war gamer would do that?
Yep.
No war gamer would do that.
That's right.
Probably me. I'm pretty bad at most. Okay.
Well, I think there's chess players who want ultimate control.
Yeah.
And there's people who want the battlefield experience where
that's exactly
they want
right.
a taste of the chaos. They don't want total chaos. They want a taste of the chaos.
Right. And you call it historically weighted chaos.
I like that. Yeah. That's great. I like that. Can I steal that?
Yeah, sure.
It's like historically weighted chaos. I love it.
Yeah, chaos that could happen in real life.
Yeah.
We're going to go for barely contained chaos here. And, you know, when we
sorry,
when we go for the fall assembly, look, I truthfully, like I could just leave the mic on and like go eat dessert and come back and just have Keith and Herman still going. And then edit it together later. And then
fine. Are you saying I'm Gabby? You'd be right. But there you go.
Down the rabbit hole
the road. And so at some point our audience's commute will be done and they're going to want to, you know, like have to go into work instead of.
I apologize.
I'm sorry. I just get chatty and it's Herman.
I'm kidding. No, you guys, this is fantastic. And look, we seriously could go another 3 hours, but somebody's got to edit this together afterwards. So look, Plus, as I noted, Mike's got to get on the road here in a couple of hours. So,
oh, sorry, Mike.
Yeah, sorry, Mike. Do drive safely.
I do want to thank both Keith and Herman for making the time to join us on the podcast, and especially for making the time to show up to the fall assembly. So that's going to be really awesome to have you guys there. And you know, at some point, like the Mike that runs the store is probably going to be like kicking you guys out and say, guys, go talk somewhere else. And you know, like,
I'm running a real store. I got to go home. Yes.
but I do. So Mike, I do want to throw this over to you in terms of what's coming up with fall assembly, whether it's the event, it's hanging out with the guys, it's checking out the store, whatever. What's one thing you're really looking forward to in terms of us finally pulling off our own real world convention here?
I think hopefully meeting some of the Dragoons I've never met is certainly one thing I look forward to. And then meeting these designers again and seeing these guys again, that's going to be awesome. And helping Steve carry his inventory into the Gamers Army. I'm really looking forward to
discreetly carrying his inventory. Yes.
Carrying it right back out the back door where Mike's conveniently parked. Where
my car is waiting, running car.
Yeah, so
that's awesome.
That's why the Gamer's Armory is built into a hill. I can't do that.
Maybe that's the secret game vault in the hill. Yeah.
There you go.
There actually is a bit of a bunker out the back door of the store. Which
I knew it.
That's where they keep a lot of the extra inventory. But you know, look, Gamer's Armory started originally as a mail order store, and then Scott later opened the brick and mortar location. But he ran it as a mail order business out of his garage for the first 7 or 8 years that it existed. And so that mail order business is still kind of the core shtick for them that they've done forever. And
that's fascinating. Usually it goes the other way around.
Yeah. For him, not so much. And that's why they were one of the stores that was able to survive COVID as well as they were, even though the brick and mortar part of the store had to shut down. Like, they couldn't have customers come in the door. They were so used to dealing with mail order inventory, and people were already so used to ordering stuff from them through the mail that it just sort of shrugged and kept doing that. You know, they cut back the hours, they saved on the electric bill, but they were able to maintain a decent flow of business, not great obviously, but a decent flow of business through their mail order, which was fantastic, because it's a great store and we love having them here in town, so that did definitely help them. Audience, thank you very much for sticking with us through this, you know, hour and plus of having some fun hanging out with designers, with Keith and with Herman here, and me and Mike occasionally getting a word in.
I'm sorry.
Why would you guys be apologizing? That's
because we get Gabby. I mean, Herman, don't we get Gabby?
Gabby. We got off on a tangent there.
Yeah.
The game design is never a tangent on a game wargaming podcast. Well, true. Why would it be? But no. Thank you guys, especially for making the time to join us on the podcast.
Oh, and we're, thank we're you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Because this has been fun. And Mike, I'll let you have any last words for tonight.
I think I've already had my last words. I can't wait to get down there and start playing some games.
Fair enough.
Looking forward to seeing you guys there. Definitely. Yeah,
yes, absolutely. Awesome. I will bring the air game.
Yeah.
It's all testing, basically.
We're a week out. So we'll be together here in just a couple of days. There's probably still a couple of tickets available for any audience members that are thinking, you know, wow, this sounds cool enough, I need to actually show up. So come on down and join us. Cary, North Carolina is a suburb of Raleigh. It's attached right next to, if you didn't see the sign that said welcome to Cary, you wouldn't know you'd changed towns. Seriously, I mean, it's right there. So, love to have folks come join us. You can find all the information on the Armchair Dragoons website, armchairdragoons.com. We're going to have a ton of photos and some video from the convention, and we're going to try to do a little bit of live streaming while we're there. Again, you know, the signal's not great just because of where the building's situated. We're going to try and do something live while we're there as well. And so you get a chance to kind of wave at Herman and Keith while we're there as well. We're looking forward to doing this.
Just bring us snacks.
I'm going to bring the media.
We'll stay at the table as long as you feed us.
And some bourbon too, please.
And some bourbon free.
Because we're in somebody's store, we're not allowed to have the alcohol in there because they're not licensed to have the alcohol in the store.
Well, then it's a good thing I don't drink.
Come talk to me.
Have it on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Is there a bar next door? I mean, everything else was next door.
Out of a plain brown bag.
There is a bar across the street. And then across the street, the other direction, there's a middle school. So make sure you go the right direction.
Oh, yeah.
Looking for the alcohol.
My reading glasses on. Yeah.
Yeah. But seriously, audience, thank you very much for sticking with us. We appreciate you joining us for this. And
And again, you know, as I mentioned back at the beginning of the show, if you get a chance, go follow that link over to Apple's podcast or our podcast page on Apple's site and throw a rating at us. Again, we're just trying to get enough ratings that we actually start showing up in the recommendation engine so that other people can discover Mention and Dispatch. We've had some great reviews over the years, and we managed to actually not pay anybody for any of them, which is kind of astounding. When you read some of them, you'd think there's no way these people said this without being bribed. But it's nice that folks have good things to say. We just want a few more stars to start showing up so that other folks can discover the podcast. We'll catch you guys next time after the Fall Assembly on another episode of Mention and Dispatches. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.